Osiris.
This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer. This is The Road to Now.
Yeah, Ben, this week I spoke with Amy Walter, who is the national editor of the Cook Political Report. And she's also hosts the Takeaway podcast. Has been covering Congress and congressional races since the early 1990s. And I asked her to put that period of American history in context for us, individuals in this country who can analyze polling data as well as Amy. So it's a great conversation. Let's get at it. And then you and I can discuss it on the other end.
Hey friends, you're listening to The Road to Now, which means that you like to listen and learn. Well, what if I told you there was a way that you could, when this episode wraps up, that you could just go to another place and not just get a podcast, but get books that would do it the same way? Ladies and gentlemen, one of our sponsors, Libro.fm, is an audiobook company that lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for booksellers around the country, and we've even got a Road to Now playlist there, so you can find books by our previous guests, including Jefferson Cowie, Edward Baptist, so many great authors. I listen to books all the time on Libro, and I just love it. One of the things that I do is I love listening to novels, right, to fiction. I don't spend a lot of time reading fiction, but when you get a book written by one of the great authors, a lot of times they read them themselves and have other voices. So I listened to B.J. Novick's One More Thing, which is one of my favorite pieces of fiction, short stories that I've read in forever. And I loved it so much, I got it so I could listen to B.J. Novick read it. And it was like a whole new experience. So go to Libro.fm and you can use our promo code RTN. And with that, you'll get 3 months of audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. Which means that for just $15, you'll get 3 months, one book a piece, and go get yourself a big book if you want to. You know, you can get a whole month out of something like a Grant biography or Washington biographies. So, guys, if you love what we're doing and you love your local bookstore, please support us and go to Libro.fm. That's Libro.fm. Enter the promo code RTN. And join us there. We hope that you'll support them. As I said, I was a member of Libro before. We picked them up as a sponsor. I actually approached them myself and said, will you sponsor us? Because I love their model. So go check them out. You can go to Libro.fm or you can go to our episode page. There's links on every one of those. Check them out. Thank you guys for supporting us and enjoy this episode.
Amy Walter, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
We're thrilled to have you here, Amy, and you're the perfect person to talk about this with me. When I think about today's political climate, the only historical parallel I can draw upon are the 1850s. And it's not so much specifics, obviously, as it is the current chaos within both parties, right? It's easy for us, you know, we get 150 years plus between now and the 1850s, and we can reflect about the demise of the Whig Party or the nativist movement of the Know-Nothing Party, the rise of the Republican Party, and of course, the debate over slavery that underlined all of that. You've been covering politics for 25 years about. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less.
Yes, that is right. I thought you were going to say 125 years.
No,
it's only 25. So I've not seen all of those movements, just a couple. But 25 years.
But maybe you can help us. You've had a front row seat over that 25 years.
That's true.
You've seen the Gingrich Revolution to Donald Trump. Can you put this in some kind of historical? I mean, do you ever like wake up in the morning and be like, oh my gosh, what have I witnessed? Help us through Amy Walter's brain, help us put this in historical context.
Bob, that's a great way to think about it. And I think, like so much of history, as you know, especially for people who are living in moments, you don't really realize you're living in a moment until many, many, many years later. And so if I really go back and think about the last 25 years, it makes, I think, a lot more sense where we ended up than if you had literally just been dropped into the United States today with no context around all of this. And I mean, I think what we've seen, you know, really since 1992 is similar to what we've seen at other times in American history, right? Which I find the most fascinating, quite frankly, is the coalitions that the parties put together and their durability over time. And the coalition that put Ronald Reagan into the White House, that put George H.W. Bush in the White House, and that put Clinton in the White House. So I came, and subsequent, but I came in during 1991. So that was really my first real professional political experience being around national politics. And, you know, you look back, just go back to what the Electoral College map looked like in the 1992 election. And you kind of can't believe that that's a map that a Democrat would have been able to put together, right?
Right. Democrats win West Virginia. They win.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
They win in Arkansas.
North Carolina.
And exactly. In Georgia. I think he won Georgia. I got to go back and double check that. But the point is, right, it was obviously a very different map than the one that we are talking about. In the same way that if I looked at the places that have gone Democratic since 1992, Virginia, Colorado, Nevada, Florida, which has gone back and forth, but went to the Democrats, places that are threatening to go Democratic, like Arizona, maybe even Texas, right? Those were not in the early 90s. That wasn't ever thought to be a reality. So it has happened in some ways very quickly, but also 25 years is a long time. And the changing demographics of the Democratic and Republican Party have happened, I would argue, sort of gradually over these 25 years. I think what Bill Clinton was able to do, he was sort of the Democrat who was first able to get the party into the suburbs and narrowly, at least, win over some of those traditionally Republican constituencies. By the time Obama came onto the scene, Democrats were doing a lot better in those suburban areas, but obviously were doing a lot worse in the southern states and rural areas that Clinton had carried. And, you know, now here we are in 2018. It feels like we've kind of come full circle to where I started in 1991, which was, you know, the year I remember 1992, the big surprise coming out of that election was how well Clinton and Democrats did in old line suburban northeastern districts like suburban Philadelphia that had been under sort of Republican machine control for years and years and years and years. And now here we are in 2018 watching Orange County, California fall to the Democrats. At the same time, you know, you've been around politics in the upper Midwest and watched Wisconsin and Minnesota and Ohio. You know, those were states that had just a rock-ribbed Democratic base that now, you know, I wrote about this recently, but I'm starting Ohio right now for the 2020 election in the likely Republican column. Wisconsin, an absolute pure toss-up. Iowa, leaning Republican. And Minnesota, the two states that when I started in politics were the most consistently Democratic and the Iron Range and in the southern tier of that state were just flipped to the Republicans in 2018. But the two districts in and around the suburbs of the Twin Cities, which have been Republican forever, flipped Democrat. So that's one significant change. The most important, though, I think, is just the speed at which information can get disseminated among voters. So social media, the internet, all of those things have really changed the way that voters interact with candidates or campaigns and campaigns interact with them, how information gets to them. and the ways in which we have seen the ability of the internet really take that, plus the change in campaign finance laws, really has undercut the party. I mean, I feel like the parties are much less relevant today than they were back in the early 90s. The DNC, the RNC just don't play as big of a role as they once did. And again, I think it's partly because candidates can create their own fundraising apparatus online. And that means that the party just does not have the influence and the power it once did.
You talk about coalitions. And are we seeing with Trump, so much of it is about cult of personality? Because you have many people in the Republican Party today, or who are sitting in Congress as Republicans. Some of them were part of this Tea Party movement, which was this populist but yet constitutional movement. And they're completely going against the ideology that they ran on, like, you know, deficits, being pro-military, being pro-justice, tariffs. You know, we've seen the Republicans are largely, many of them were there before Trump, but yet they've changed what they believe in as a result of Trump.
Yeah. And so I guess that's really the fundamental question. I was just having an interview with somebody about this who's a scholar on the question of, is the Republican Party the party of Trump, or is Trump just a reflection of the party, right? That he's a more true reflection of where the party really is. And his argument, which is a very valid one, I think, is that, look, Trump has delivered something for each one of these groups within the Republican coalition. He's given fiscal conservatives, while they may not like the deficits, they sure like the tax cuts. And if you believe in supply side economics, which many of them do, then you believe that growth is going to get us out of this deficit problem, right? And what they were not saying is, maybe they were saying this, but these kinds of voters in 2010 and 11 and 12 were saying, not so much that deficits are bad, it's deficits when Democrats are in charge are bad, because they create deficits by more government spending. The only way you're going to fill the coffers is through taxes. We create deficits by tax cuts, but at least there's the potential for those coffers to be filled with by the fruits of economic growth. You can agree or disagree with that theory, but the point is, I think that's where they would say, well, Trump sort of stayed consistent on the idea of tax cuts. So he did not go full populist on them. I think, look, there were a lot of fiscal conservatives or other conservative Republicans whose really bigger fears for a Trump presidency would be that he would go against, that he wasn't a real Republican, and he would sort of revert back to the Donald Trump of Manhattan, or the Democratic Donald Trump, would reverse himself on abortion, wouldn't put real strong conservatives on the Supreme Court, would govern like a real populist with, you know, attacking China with right out of the gates. You know, remember during the campaign he talked about huge tariffs that were going to be levied on Japan and on China, that he would get out of NAFTA immediately. Well, he didn't do any of those things. Instead, he gave a pretty traditional Republican tax cut. He put traditional conservatives on the Supreme Court. He's nominating traditional conservatives to fill the lower courts on all of the social issues, whether it's abortion or transgendered military members. He has stayed very much in line with cultural conservatives. The one group that he has disappointed, and I would argue is the group that has been splintering away from him, are the moderate Republicans, who in some ways had already been leaving the party in the same way that conservative Democrats were leaving the party when Al Gore ran and then ended up maybe voting for George Bush in 2004. So that was probably the least cohesive of all of those sort of factions of the Republican Party. And they do want to see more free trade. They don't want to see a border wall or an immigration policy that is focused on restricting immigration. They do want to see, to your point, a more activist America around the world, a more muscular American presence around the world. They don't want to see big deficits, even though they may like tax cuts. So that's who Trump has lost. And you're right. So the question is, if you lose that group, who replaces them? Are there enough working class voters who like the policies, the focus of the Trump agenda to make up for the lack of Republican support or the loss of the sort of moderate Republicans, especially in these suburban areas?
Are there enough of the populist Republicans who just enjoy seeing Trump stick a thumb in the eye to the system, right?
That's right.
Yeah, they enjoy.
That's right.
Because, I mean, and you wrote in your column last week for the Cook Political Report, which I subscribe to, I recommend all our listeners do, you write.
Thank you.
You reference a January 2019 NBC Wall Street Journal poll that found just 63% of Republicans see the president as honest and trustworthy, and only about half Republicans, 53%, think he has high personal and ethical standards. It's almost laughable to even read it in a way. But and then you go on to write, by the way, only 18% of independent voters see him as honest and trustworthy or believe that he has high personal and ethical standards. Yet his standing within the Republican Party, I think as of this week, is maybe 93%.
That's right.
And
that's right.
He's maybe at his high approval rating, 46 maybe this week. And that's after the North Korea summit, which was a stalemate at best.
I don't think they were in the field. I know at least. Okay. Gallup and probably NBC, I don't know that they were in the field during the weekend, right, when he was coming back from North Korea. So, but your point is well taken, which is, look, you know, I think it's a continuation of a trend that we have seen for the last couple of weeks, which is as soon as the government shutdown ended, the president's numbers started to go back up, and that the government shutdown was the bigger depressor, if that's the right word, to his approval ratings than things that he had tweeted or said, or, you know, people getting indicted, etc. And so my point in making the case about, you know, how Republicans feel about the president, that, you know, they're not, they give him a 90% approval rating, but they only half of them see him as, you know, having high ethical standards. They've already made their peace with this, right? They don't necessarily think he's going to be the greatest guy on earth in terms of his ethics and his personal character. But that's not important, as important to them as everything else that he's doing. For people who believe that the only way for him to improve in their mind is to change the way he behaves, that's just never going to happen, right? So I think the focus on his behavior, on the tweeting, is less important to Republicans than the things he's actually been able to do. And so for Democrats, this is the challenge going forward, right? Which is, you know, you can't just, they can never assume, or they can never count on the president's base abandoning him in order for them to win. They've got to hold their own base and keep them energized, and then win over that narrow slice of swing voters who in the 2016 election narrowly went to Trump.
Let me ask you this. You've been looking at poll numbers for a long time. Are there things that you can discern after all this time about what drives the voters, what drives the citizens of this country to make the choices they make in the polling booth? Michael Ware, who served as President Obama's director of faith outreach in the 2012 campaign and advised him on religious issues during his presidency, said recently that he believes that people are looking at are seeking from politics what they used to get from religion. The sense of belonging, the sense of higher calling. Do politics mean something different in American life in 2018 than they did in 1992?
That's a really good question. I think the bigger challenge from 1992 till now is really the hollowing out of people who were moderate to conservative in the Democratic Party or were liberal to moderate in the Republican Party. Like, it's interesting, as the coalitions have changed within the Democratic and Republican Party in terms of the types of people that are now identifying themselves or voting with those parties, what has changed as well is just the ideological outlook, right? There is more acceptance in the Democratic Party of, you know, a more diverse in terms of ethnicity, in terms of religion, in terms of gender, sexual orientation. All of those things now make up the Democratic Party is incredibly diverse in terms of the kinds of people who are in the coalition. Where they are less diverse is in their ideology, right? In terms of, you're just not going to find Southern conservatives are no longer in a piece of the Democratic electorate in the same way. And so they don't have the influence in the party, and they don't have a moderating influence in terms of the agenda setting in Congress. And same with Republicans. There are no longer the Rockefeller Northeastern Republicans. They've all either abandoned the party or left the party, or they've been voted out. And many of them, as voters, are now going with Democrats. The party now on the Republican side is more uniformly conservative. And so what we've lost is the real diversity of ideological opinion within the two parties. And so when they do debate, it's like, you know, fighting on the head of a pin, right? It's who is the most conservative on X, who's the most liberal on X, as opposed to, wow, we have somebody that's really liberal on this issue and really conservative on this issue in the same coalition. What that means is there's just no way to do bipartisan work anymore, because if you were a liberal Republican, you could easily find yourself aligned with some moderate Democrats. If you were a conservative Democrat, you could align yourself with moderate Republicans. You could get bipartisan legislation passed. That doesn't happen anymore. But more fundamentally, I think, and I write about it this week, but what I think is really interesting about the time we're in is that we just fundamentally, and I'm going to try to pull this up right now, but, you know, I hear a lot of the discussion about, okay, what plagues America and how to fix it, right? Centered around this. You know, we're so divided right now. We're so polarized right now. The only way to really solve this problem is for us to find a way to become more civil, more empathetic. You know, we could solve problems if we just sat down and dialed down the rhetoric and turned off the cable television. And Arthur Brooks wrote this week in the New York Times a column where he said, what we need is not to disagree less, but to disagree better. My argument is that actually the problem we have right now isn't that we need to be more measured in our disagreements, or that we need to find a way to disagree better. It's that we disagree about the challenges and problems facing the country. And so talking honestly about our problems is really hard to do if we don't agree on the same set of problems. And Pew has looked at the priorities for Democrats and Republicans that they identify. So Republicans identify, Democrats identify themselves. They say, here are the five most important priorities that I think going forward for the country. And in 1999, improving the educational system topped the list of priorities for both Republicans and Democrats. Four of the top five issues for Republicans were listed among the Democrats' top five issues as well. Okay, so we agreed between Democrats and Republicans, right, what the problems were. Now, we're going to have different ideas on how to solve them, but at least we agreed what the problems were. Today, there is not one overlapping priority between the Democratic and Republican.
We're living in two different worlds.
We are literally living in two different worlds. And so I think we really are missing the boat if we're saying, well, we just need to find a better way to agree. No, it's not about agreeing to the – it's agreeing to the problems. And so when one party says, I want to build a wall, the other party – it's not simply that the other party says, no, I think there's a better way to build a wall than the way you're building it. They're saying that's immoral. That's racist and xenophobic. And when one party says, you know, climate change is the most existential problem and threat to our world and we need to spend everything we have on it, and the other side says, that's not a priority. That's not even really happening. Well, or if it is, there has to be, like, it's not as existential as you're making it out to be. Well, of course we're not going to have a really measured debate on environmental issues. So that, I think, really, we are just going to be talking past each other. And I don't know how that changes. I don't think it changes simply by having someone in office who is going to be more willing to be nice and sit down with the other side or act bipartisan. Because even if you have a friendlier demeanor, the fact is, if you're the president, Bob, and you're taking up issues that I don't see as priorities, well, that alone is going to make me dislike you, right? Because you're not addressing the things that are really important to me. And instead, you're spending so much capital on issues that I think are at best not a priority, or at worst are taking us in the absolute wrong direction.
And when you extend a hand to the other side and try to reach out, your own side seems to chastise you. Can I ask you one quick last question?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, you did win the Crystal Ball Award, right, in 2000 for predicting the presidential election. I'm not going to hold you to that. I'm not going to hold you to 2020 today. But
thank you.
I don't know about you, but I enjoy March Madness, college basketball. And so there aren't 64 Democrats running yet. But
no.
Could you today look into Amy Walters' crystal ball and maybe give us your final four Democrats? Because I kind of look at it like they're conferences, right? You've got the moderate conference, which is Biden and Bloomberg, and you've got the progressive conference, which would be maybe Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. You've got the outsider Western Governor Conference, which would be Bullock and Hickenlooper and such. And eventually, these two or three debate stages will be boiled down to one. Who are the final four?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I think it's really about, I mean, I think, you know, one person who seems to have, at least at this point, a pretty dedicated base of support. And the only question is it a growing base, or is this, you know, sort of his high watermark is Bernie Sanders, right? His ability to, you know, raise the kind of money he raised after his kickoff is impressive.
Were you surprised?
I don't know that I was surprised given how well he did, but it certainly was the magnitude of difference between Sanders and, say, any of the other candidates is definitely noteworthy, right? That, you know, folks are bragging about, I raised $2 million, I raised $1.5 million, and this guy's like, well, I raised 10. That's a big deal. So it just seems to me that if you've got, you know, 25% of the Democratic vote, that could help get you into the finals. I sort of look at it somewhat similarly to you, where I think there is not simply the progressive voice, but really these folks who are much more about disruptive progressivism versus a pragmatic progressivism, right? So a Warren, a Sanders, those are the real disruptors, right? And so I kind of see that there is a lane for a disruptor, somebody who's just not simply going to be liberal, but is saying, oh, no, I want to make a fundamental change to the way this country is, the way that we're going to solve our problems. Then you have the progressive pragmatist. And there you have a whole lot of different categories, right? You have, I guess the question is, do you get one or two out of that bracket? And because you have the folks like Sherrod Brown, who is, you could categorize him in some ways as a populist, but he's also very much of a pragmatist on issues like the Medicare for All issue or Green New Deal. He's not jumping on those bandwagons. And then there's the more traditional pragmatist, the Amy Klobuchar, the Joe Biden, Terry McAuliffe, maybe you could even call them more establishment types. I also think that it's hard for me to believe that there won't be a woman or and or a candidate of color in that final four. Could it happen? Yes. Is it likely to happen? No.
So will the Republican Party let Donald Trump have a challenger?
Oh, I don't know how much they can avoid doing it. I know that they're talking about closing primaries and things like that. I don't know how that really works. I think the real question, right, is whether there is someone who finds a weakness in that Trump Republican armor. And thus far, there's a pretty small chink, you know? And I don't know that Trump's threat right now is going to come from within his own party. I think the bigger threat to the president is that, you know, he keeps his base, but unlike 2016, the other side, his opposition, is more engaged and enraged than they were in 2016. And that independent voters, swing voters, who Trump, he did win those with 46% in 2016, they break against him more significantly this time around.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you. Thank you for making me think through all of this. It was fun.
It was a blast. Let's do it again in the future.
All right.
All right.
Take care.
Have a great day. So, Ben, Amy gives us a lot to think about when we're considering the different coalitions that make up political parties today. The point she made that we really need to consider is when she talked about how it's not a matter of we agree on the issues, but we don't agree on how to solve them. We don't even agree on the issues.
Yeah, like the biggest issues for each party don't exist for the other party in many cases. It's not, like she said, you know, it's not... what's a better way to control immigration or build a better wall?
The wall is immoral.
Yeah. Or like, you know, it's not a question of like, you know, how do we differences of opinion on how to battle climate change? It's like,
climate change
like,
doesn't exist.
So it's like, oh my God.
It's either the greatest threat to humanity. It's the greatest threat in the history of the earth, or it just doesn't exist, or it's false.
Or you made it up. It's like, that's a hell of a swing, man. That's a hell of a swing.
And then the same thing with, we have a humanitarian and an immigration crisis at the border that demands a wall, or, well, we really don't have a, historically, if you look at numbers, immigration's down 40%, while border crossings are down 40% historically, and we don't have a crisis. Or we have a situation that needs a remedy, but it doesn't rise to the level of emergency.
Yeah, Bob, it's funny because I'm gonna put my, you know, put things on my sleeve right here. It's become, in the last like month or so, it's become harder and harder for me to invest myself in conversations like this. Although, before I say this, you made some great points. I agree with the 1850s, your analogy, right? Because coalitions are falling apart. And one of the things that's become clearest to me, I've been thinking about this a lot, is like how, you know, starting in the late 1840s, like, the strategy for winning a presidency was not run the guy, right? It wasn't like it used to be, like run Jefferson, run Monroe, right? It became run people that are kind of unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still unknown, like Franklin Pierce, anybody?
Yes.
James Buchanan, anybody? Like, you know?
Right, Millard Fillmore.
Right. And so it's like, that to me is like struck me because I thought about, you know, the way I always talk about the 2016 election is like, you know, Republicans spent 20 years digging a Hillary Clinton-shaped hole in the ground. And people were like, but what if they don't run her? Like, this won't work. And they were like, they'll run her. And it worked, you know? So it's like, there is a real advantage to running an outsider. And someone like Trump, he really, like, that black space, that kind of, like, unknown, which was what he would do politically, really, really paid off for him, right? Because you had a known, and then, well, he could be anything. We're not sure. At least maybe if we flip the coin, you know, if we go that way, then maybe something will happen. So, yeah, I think the 1850s analogy was brilliant. I've been saying this recently, too. But, like, this is where I'll put my honest opinion out there. The only politician talking about any issue that matters is Andrew Yang. I mean, nobody is talking about what AI is going to do to us. Nobody is talking about dealing with the fact that we're going to automate away 3.5 million truck driver jobs in the next 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. Nobody's talking about the fact that the most common job in America right now is retail work, and that work is going to go away. He's the only one who's talking about it, and the people that are on board with him, it's the first time in my life I've seen it where who supports him is not whether or not they're Republican, Libertarian, Democrat, or whatever. It's just reasonable people. All my smart friends who are Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians, once I start talking to them about it, they like it. And it's because for the first time, somebody's actually talking about it. And I feel like, you know, Donald Trump's trying to take us back to a horse and carriage, and the Democratic Party's been fighting over how to build a better carburetor. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, don't get me wrong, that's better. But, like, it's not the future. And this goes back to, you know, what I was saying. I wrote a blog post last year about, like, basically, you know, hindsight is not 2020. And the whole point was that, you know, we're in American society and politics has been in a state of denial about the end of the World War II moment since Jimmy Carter had the audacity to say something about it in the late 70s. And the Republicans have been in the anger stage and the Democrats have been in the denial stage. And those are early stages of grief. And, like, finally, Yang showed up and was like, dude, it's over. Let's cope with it. Let's talk about real issues and not just, like, right now and talking about, like, should we get back to the 1870s or the 1960s? Let's talk about what's going to happen in the 2020s and the 2030s. And once – I feel like once you – I read his book, The War on Normal People, and, like, I can't care about – just none of this other stuff makes sense to me anymore. I mean, it already didn't, but now that you see all the issues that are on the table that we're just ignoring, it's so hard for me to – for me to think about it. Like, what is the difference between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and all of them? I it's so minute.
Well, okay. Well then, because, in the spirit of Amy, Walter, who is a master at analyzing the data.
Right.
Yeah, and the polling
amazing.
Data.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah.
Let's look at Andrew Yang from a numbers standpoint.
Okay.
So you have a Democratic primary where you're going to have, you know, it's going to start out if Biden gets in, he probably will. Biden's got, let's say he got 20%. Bernie, let's say he's got 15% starting out. Warren will maybe have 10%. Harris maybe have 10 to 7%. Like, how is a guy like in a field of 20, how does an Andrew Yang, who I bet, you know, most people have never heard of, how does he get any oxygen?
Bob, you ever, when you were a kid, watch WWF?
Oh, every Saturday morning.
Remember when they'd have the Battle Royale where they put like 30 people in the ring?
Yeah.
And it'd be like Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant.
You know it was Jimmy Snuka was going to win, or this is pre-Hulk Hogan, Bob Backlund might win.
Yeah, but some, like, frequently, one of the top guys would go out early, right? The point is that in that crowded field, like, there is a possibility, and I don't know. I guess that's one analogy, but the reality is like this guy, since he went on Joe Rogan a month ago, I mean, I knew about him before because I listened to Sam Harris previously, Waking Up, Now Making Sense. And he's the guy who, before he was like really talking seriously about running for the Democratic ticket, convinced me that the universal basic income, like I was already thinking about it, and his argument was so beautiful for it. And
that that's where I've heard him speak. That was the issue on which I became aware of him.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing is, you know, you look at it, how many people are going to be fighting for votes in these early polls? Well, yeah, they've got more name recognition. But like when you sit down and look at the policies of those folks, there are differences, right? I'm not saying there aren't differences. I'm saying there aren't substantial differences. The only one that has anything that stands out from them, as far as I know, is Andrew Yang. And he's talking reasonable. Like one of the things people like about Bernie Sanders.
Wait, Ben, hold on. When does reasonable have anything to do with politics?
In 2020, Bob.
In 2016, in 2012. It's silly season, right? Presidential elections are silly season. Reason doesn't factor into it.
I don't know. I don't know. I have faith, man. I mean, this is the thing, Bob. Like, one thing that I've learned by us doing this podcast and being in a podcast is that, and you know, the surge has happened really since 2016 with people listening to podcasts. Mm-hmm. It has created a space for reasonable conversation.
Well, podcasts had their best year last year. Ever.
Yeah, and there's a reason for it. It's because, Bob, when we sit down and talk to somebody, we're no longer under the constraints of a commercial break. We're no longer under the constraints of like, oh, what if an advertiser pulls? We're not under those constraints in the same way that the big ones are. And we can have reasonable conversations where we talk to somebody for an hour. Where would you get that before? And people listen, millions and millions of people listen to it. And that has revealed to me, despite what we see and what we think, people are reasonable. And they want to listen to something reasonable. And I just think that, you know, not just Yang, which I'm a huge fan of. Obviously, I'm working on his campaign in Nashville. Like I'm trying to get people out for him. But any candidate that starts speaking that language of reasonability has a hell of a swing now in their favor because of the fact that, like, in places where you can't see it, because podcasts largely exist off of the mainstream, you know, outside of mainstream culture. But in places you can't see it, there has been a revolution of reasonability. And I just think that's where my hope is. And maybe 2020 is not the year for Yang, but if even we can start talking about it, I think that we can, you know, things can start pushing in the right direction. So there's that. The other stuff that fascinates me, Bob, is like, you talk about like how desperate people are just to have somebody to root for. Like the fact that you pointed out that like even in the Republican Party, like 53% of the Republicans see Donald Trump as having high moral standards or whatever that was, but 93% of them love him. Come on, man. Like, who are we?
It's loving him because he's, like I said, sticking a thumb in the eye of the Democrats or the liberals or yeah. It's the wrestling analogy. It's being a fan of the heavy, the heel.
Sure. And that's the issue is that, like, you know, it's a broad stroke to say this because I know there are reasonable people, you know, like I love Hickenlooper, man. Like, I think that guy is an amazing leader. So I don't want to throw everyone out with it. And I don't want to throw, you know, people in the Democratic Republican Party out in general. But like the mood that I always hear is just we're against the person that is bad. So like, you know, if you're in the Republican Party, like what's Trump's message? China's bad. Immigrants are bad. It's being against, right? Taxes are bad. If you look at the Democratic Party, it's like, well, Trump is bad. Republicans are bad. Now Russia's bad. Like, you know, it's just where is the moving forward? And like, we need somebody who will talk past all of that and be like, look, guys, like we love each other, right? I mean, we do. We have so much in common in America, so much in common. I mean, if you think about it, we argue about a lot of things, but like at the core of it is, this is a great place we should care about. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, it is.
That's a hell of a lot to agree upon. Like we agree that we should be, that we should set high standards for ourselves. That other people can look up to. And sometimes that can come across as egotistical, but at the core of that is a real value that like we should be worthy of leadership. And I think that if, you know, we just got to start talking about those things and have new ideas. And that's why I'm so into Yang. I'll stop talking about him now. Andrew Yang 2020. Anyway, what do you think, Bob? What's your take on it?
Thank you for asking, Ben. Thank you for asking.
I'm happy to. Bob, you're one of the moral compasses in my life. So like I care a lot about what you think about this stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, I have trouble because I am unapologetically an anti-Trumper. I'm a non-Trumper. And I just feel like, you know, here's an argument I heard this week. I listened to talk radio and I heard someone say, you know, in this time of podcasts, I still do more listening to radio than I do listening to podcasts. And someone said, talking about with regard to the president's paying off of porn stars, so as a way of not losing the election, right?
And allegedly Fox News buried a story about that as well.
Fox News buried a story about, you know, at any other time, it didn't matter who it was, who did it, a Democrat or a Republican, that would be it for that person, right? Mm-hmm. Curtains. Yeah. Well, the caller called into the radio show and he said, well, didn't Obama do cocaine when he was young?
Oh, God.
So the president broke the law, campaign finance violation, but Obama did admitted to doing cocaine. So it's even. We're all bad people. And so we've reached this moral, it's this moral relativism.
I think that caller should have considered the fact that he would say that we're all bad people is something that Donald Trump himself would never say.
But he would, but Trump would say that. That's what Trump says. He says, talked about that radio clip we played several months back where they asked Trump about his feeling about Putin killing journalists. He's like, Trump said, we do it too. We're bad people too. We kill people too.
Well, I was thinking more individually himself.
You know, but it's this idea that we can't, like, you and I are constantly trying to teach our children right from wrong.
Right.
Right? Yeah. We're sinners. Yeah. We've fallen far short. Yeah. We made stupid mistakes. You know, we're not immune to it, but it doesn't mean that we can't demand from our leaders honesty.
Right.
And truth, and telling the truth. Our nation is built on the rule of law. And now it seems like laws are relative. You admit you're a fan of Andrew Yang. I admit I'm not a fan of the president. Okay, that's our personal feelings. But so where does this fit in with the coalitions? So for me, I would like to see moderate Democrats. So you have this progressive movement in the Democratic Party. I'd like to see the moderate Democrats and the moderate Republicans come together. You know, I want to see some, I feel like we're going to see these party coalitions shift a little bit. And I guess we're seeing it per Amy Walter with those suburban Republicans moving into the Democratic camp. But how far to the left will they go? Right? How much will they tolerate? They don't like Trump, so they're going to support the Democrats in an election or two, right? But what policies could a Democratic candidate put forward that's going to make them say, I don't like Trump, but I got to stick with him because I can't do this. I can't do single payer. This carbon tax, I can't abide that. Or, you know, whatever the policy is, or breaking up of Amazon or breaking up a Google like Elizabeth Warren's proposing, or free college for everybody. There may be some
of
these
ideas, Bob.
These suburban Republicans, they're not going to stick with the Democrats on that. They're going to stick with Trump. So what I'm saying is there needs to be a new party that rises out of that. You know, there needs to be I think for the health of the country, we need a healthy liberal party and a healthy conservative party.
Yeah.
We've always kind of had that. Now we don't have that. We have a rising liberal progressive agenda right on the left with a lot of energy behind it. And then we have a sick, you know, a Republican party that's it's sick because you have, and I meant when I say sick, I mean, not vibrant and healthy, bringing forth healthy conservative ideas. You know what I'm saying? They are supporting a cult of personality. They're playing the transactional Trump game. It's all transactional. There is no aspiration for higher calling. Exactly. It's all about, these are the things we want and we're going to do. We're going to scorch the earth to get it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll bring it down. It's that mentality I always talk about, which is like just, in a lot of the world, coming home and not having a job, but being able to say, well, I told him that's as good as having a job. You know what I'm saying? To some folks, it's just like, well, I told him I didn't put up with that anymore. I told him. And it's like, well, you know, right now that's great. I'm sure you feel good about yourself, but what are you doing? You took a step backwards, right? You got to be moving forwards. But yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I just don't know because all these ideas have been tried and floated. And I just think it's like, we need a Frances Perkins, man.
Mm-hmm.
We need a Frances Perkins.
But she wasn't a leader, meaning that she was a leader, but her strength, she made things work behind the scenes.
But she showed up and was like, I won't be part of your coalition unless you push for a 40-hour work week. And FDR was like, that'll never happen. And she was like, well, then I guess I won't be on your team. And she was like, I'll try to make it happen. And it happened.
But so that didn't mean that – that means that the leader needs to be willing to surround themselves, be it a man or a woman, with people who they respect their ideas. And the leader needs to be able to take other people's counsel. preferably people that aren't pundits on Fox News.
Yeah. People who are thinking forward. I mean, that's
we don't have that. We don't have that. We're deficient in that. And I think when you have the sickness on the right, it breeds a sickness on the left. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Because no matter how, you have an extreme on one end and it's going to provoke. Remember, do you remember George W. Bush? And then in Iran, you had Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, dude.
And weren't they the perfect? But didn't George Bush's election secure Ahmadinejad's election?
Yeah, some would say.
Yeah,
because Bush started talking all that rhetoric, right. And then someone crazy like Ahmadinejad was able to establish a base and be like, "See, I told you they were as crazy as I told you they were."
Exactly. So, and we see this happening with the Democratic Party, that they're becoming. You know, Trump talked about all these things, these crazy Democrats, and some of these Democrats are going to, in response to him, are going to look like crazy Democrats.
Yeah. I mean, this.
We need the middle, Ben. We need the middle.
We don't need the middle. We need the forward.
Well, we need it where people can accept that the person you elect may not be a perfect person, but you can believe what they say, right? Like they're not a perfect individual, but they're an honest person.
Yeah, yeah.
And we need it in this country. We do need some compromises to where. I don't get everything I want, and you don't get everything you want, but we move forward.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't know, and this is the problem, I just don't know where in any of this we're going to move forward. Like, free college education. Okay, great. Look at college graduation rates, Bob. Like, the same percentage of the college of the American population has a college degree, like 32, 33%. It's had it like 20 years ago, but we've increased the number of people going to college because we've told them all they had to go to college, and we've subsidized college loans, and then we pull the floor out from underneath that under the Bush administration. So now we've shackled people to debt. It's like about 60% of people that start college graduate 6 years later. Like, so free college, like, is that really a good idea? You want to, it's not to me. And I teach there.
I agree.
And you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, well, what do we do? And that's where it's like, you know, again, Andrew Yang's got the best policies on that. Cause he's just like, look, here's what we got to do. Like we bailed out General Motors. Why wouldn't we bail out the American people that are shackled and entrepreneurs being held down by this debt now? They can't buy houses. They can't start their lives off. Buy it out and then in a 10 by 10 plan. You pay 10% of your income for 10 years and you're done. And then we get the cost down. And you know why college is so expensive now, Bob? Like look where the money goes. 2.5 times more expensive than it was in the 1990s. Faculty doesn't get paid more. Students aren't getting a better education. The facilities aren't any better than they used to be. That's all gone to administrative bloat. Not all of it, but almost all of it, to create deans and associate deans and assistant deans who have to look like they're doing work. So they create more work for the people who are already teaching. And you know what? You just keep on bringing those people up there, paying them 6 figures. And now students are paying more and they don't understand why. They're only there for 4 years. Nobody's talking about that. You could substantially reduce the cost of a college education just by getting rid of the people that actually don't. I would say they don't do anything, but in fact, what they do is they make it harder for the people that actually do things there.
Well, Ben, it sounds like you're saying that the proletariat needs to reclaim the means of production.
No, because I'm not divisive like that. I think we Americans need to reclaim America for the things we want. Why are we scared of AI? Like, we're all scared our jobs are going to go away.
I agree with what you're saying with Andrew Yang. He brings up the point, like, what are we going to do with all the truck drivers? Like, yeah. where are we need to create jobs for the people who are about to lose their jobs. And where Trump's solution to this was, A, deny AI, B, revitalize manufacturing. Well, that's never going to happen.
Because those jobs are going to be gone. They're disappearing as we speak. And that's why I say it's like we need to not just think about like what's a new job. We need to think about like we live in a country that's the richest country that's like ever existed. Like why do we have so many poor people? Like we need to think of a way that's fair, that unlocks entrepreneurialism and doesn't make us afraid of losing jobs that none of us actually like to do.
Yeah, it's definitely not about socialism. It's about reviving capitalism.
Right. Right. Bob, your interview with Amy Walter was awesome. Thank you for doing it and then having this conversation with me.
Yeah, and let's not talk about this stuff for like another 6 months.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. As always, also, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, and the newest one, Susan Sharp. If you'd like to support us and what we do, you can do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. We're working on some pretty cool stuff over there, so I'm excited to share that with y'all. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.